Today is the 1st of June 2008. We start the lesson number 5, first course about the history of Buddhism and the Buddhist school. Before we begin the lesson, we recite the name of the Buddha Shakyamuni 3 times. Namo Bonasa Thika Muni Padma Namo Bonasa Thika Muni Padma Namo Bonasa Thika Muni Padma. Now we have learned about the histories of Buddhism in India, in China, in Vietnam. Now we start to the 5th lesson about Buddhist revival movement. Buddhist revival movement, you understand what it means, right? Movement, you know, to shake up a little bit, because it has been in decay. Buddhism has been in decay during the last centuries. You remember the histories of Buddhism in India? It has almost disappeared after the 15th century. And in China, it has met, you know, with different elements, especially esotericism, which is what we call by superstition. People come to the temple just to pray, just to ask for something, and they believe that the Buddha is God, or not even the Buddha. They venerate the Kuan Yin, and they think that Kuan Yin, the godmother, and they pray to them, to her, I mean, for anything. So, basically, the Buddhism, as taught by Buddha Shakyamuni, has been in decadence. Even in Vietnam, because of the invasion of the French, many temples now have been in decay, and many people have been converted into Christianism, which has not been present at the time. Not only in these countries, but in other countries, we have not learned, like Myanmar, Thailand, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, which are the, what we call by Buddhist countries. But we remember the master Thich Nhat Hanh, the one who wrote these lessons, he was not really versed in the time, into the history of these countries. So now you have more chance to learn about the world. We are in the world now. The world is smaller now. And you can find information easier than at the time. So we don't blame them, we understand the problem at the time. And now we learn about this revival movement of Buddhism, which is basically the spreading of Buddhism in all over the world nowadays. Because you remember in the time of Buddhism, even in the 18th or 19th century, was mostly confined into some areas only. But since this lesson has been written in the 1950s, at the most in the early 1960s, so many countries have not been covered, and many areas have not been covered. I try to add them as we have time. Because you see, in Norway, Buddhism has been present there for thousands of years. You didn't know that, right? There was vestige in it. There was what we call by findings about Buddhism in there. And in fact, I have a book called The History of Buddhism in Norway. And in fact, most of the first Norwegian, were Buddhist. Now the finding was very interesting. But now we go into the lesson. Introduction. In the 18th and 19th centuries, Buddhist practice, especially in Asia, fell in decadence, withering out in contact with Occidental civilization. Asian countries neglected spiritual heritage for the benefit of material wealth. Basically, what does it mean is that people get used to something. They get used to Buddhism. People in these countries, so-called Buddhist countries, they get used to Buddhism. And then some monks, some lay people start to try to learn more, to study more. They just think that, well, we go to temple and give something to the monk and go home. That's it. And they don't practice. They don't even want to learn more. Whenever you ask someone to come to the temple to pray, to dance, to listen to something, to have a festival, they come like in mass. But if you say that, well, come to the temple to learn about something, to sit down, to zazen, things like this, oh, I'm busy here, oh, I'm tired, or whatever. So then, a lot of people, whenever nowadays we say something in Buddhism, they don't even understand, although they call themselves Buddhists. So the decadence comes from there, because they lose interest in Buddhism. But like I told you before, you can spend your many time, lifetime, to learn about Buddhism, and there's still something to learn about that. And there's some very interesting things, many interesting things to learn about. In fact, that is the reason why Buddhism spread out now in the world and will be the only religion left in the world after all these organized religion will disappear because of their fighting. So, Asian countries neglected spiritual heritage for the benefit of material wealth. Material wealth is in dire contrast with what the Buddha taught. That is, material wealth is impermanent. It's not real. It will disappear. But people don't see that because they just say that, well, you said that, but now I need money. I need the car. I need to have a big house. I need to have something. So whenever the Occidental civilization come in contact with them, now they were like a flash out. They were like in awe. They think, well, all these French, all these English people, they are very good. They have a good life. They drink wine and play around all the time. And they have slaves. They have servants. And now we just come to the temple and we are the servant to the monks. Right? A lot of people think like that. So then they start to think over. And then they don't believe in what the monks teach them anymore. Or they put them in doubt. And with our guidance, because even the monks at the time were not really learned. Because according to Buddhism, you see, remember that with the Vinaya, the monks are not supposed to learn about the worldly things. So they cannot get in touch with the disciple, with the Buddhists, with the lay people. You see, like you are here, but whenever there's a monk coming in, you should come in and listen to them. And who among you will go and listen to them? You see? And they excuse it up. I don't understand. I don't know what's saying. Right? Just say the truth. So either the monk must learn to speak English, or you have to learn to speak Vietnamese to understand them. Now, the easiest solution is to make the monk speak English. Because in that case, he can spread Buddhism out. But many monks, are not really willing to do that. Truthfully. And on the other hand, Buddhists don't want to learn Vietnamese. They say, well, why should I? They come here, they need to spread Buddhism to Americans. So then your argumentation is also valid. But then, it stopped there because it does not resolve anything. We don't come into any solution. So the younger monks, start to learn French, English, German, and try to spread out. That is what we call by revival movement. After a while, Asians found flaws in Occidental civilizations and returned to study their own heritage, starting a universal revival movement. It's like, people from Asian countries, when they learn about all these protectorates, on these master countries, they call them mother countries like England, France, Germany, they start to get into their civilization. And then they try to come over there. And then suddenly, after a while, they start to see that, well, French or English or Germans have the same problem. They might be a little bit wealthier, but they are also poor people. They are also unhappy people. And dukkha, the suffering, is universal. It was exactly what did the Buddha taught. But then, It's not there because most Buddhists or most Asian people didn't know much about Buddhism. Even the teachers, the monks, didn't know much about Buddhism properly. So they start now to dig down into it, to investigate into Buddhism. We learn about that. So return to study their own heritage and starting a universal revival movement, which helped Buddhism. Because on the sutras, on the teaching of the Buddhas, have been buried down for a long time. Now they try to dig them up. Main subject, revival movement in, we divide into these areas. Revival movement in India and the surrounding countries, which are mostly Hinayana, that is small Vedic countries. India, Myanmar, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Khmer country, that is Cambodia. And the revival movement in China and surrounding countries, mostly Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. In the lesson from the master, there was no Korean. Because truthfully, at the time, very few people understand about that, know about that. But I added it in. Diffusion of Buddhism in the world, that is, in mostly Occidental countries. In the rest of the world, like I just told you, we think that it started to spread after the 18th country. But truthfully, it has been present there a long time. Even in America, in the United States of America. You remember Thoreau, right? David Thoreau? He was one of the first Buddhists. You don't know that? Learn more. Try to go to Wikipedia or somewhere and learn more about his life. In fact, Buddhism in America, has been present for a long, long, long time. And many thinkers at the time were Buddhists. And they are still Buddhists. And in fact, there are like more than 10 million American Buddhists now. You don't know them. But even in Jacksonville here, we have like 7 different groups of American Buddhists. And they meet regularly. You might have met with someone already. But they practice more than us, truthfully. When they sit down, they receive the Jukai, that is what is called by Thọ Giới. They receive the 5 precepts. They sit down and they solve their own kesa. They have to sew their own kesa to wear. And they put on every time they meet and sit down. Since they practice a lot, we take pity on them because they don't have enough masters. We have a chance to get a lot of masters. We had a few, now we have a lot of masters. That is a real monk who go into celibacy, who studies, and then who transmit their knowledge to us nowadays. So we are lucky, and don't spoil it, because someday they will be gone. But basically, the diffusion of Buddhism in the world means all that. And the International Buddhist Conventions, that was in the time of the masters, because in 1950, Vietnam just got into independence. So then everybody become elated, and they think that, if some other countries in the world talk about Buddhism, that was very something honor. That is, they know about us nowadays. But they didn't even know that Buddhism has been present in the world for a long time. But they have been duped by some missionaries into thinking that Buddhism was dead. Buddhism was superstitious and things. They tried to blind people. A revival movement in Vietnam, that was only until the 1950s. Because this book, this lesson had been written at that time. So now we go first into the revival movement in India, in the surrounding countries. Indian Buddhism, this is easy to understand, right? Birthplace of Buddhism, India, shown only until the 10th century. You already know that, because we have learned about the history of Buddhism in India. So after that, the Muslims come in at the 13th century. So, first, the Brahmanism change. Brahmanism, that is the Brahma change. They started to adopt many Buddhist thinking. They stopped eating meat, and they act differently. And they even assimilate Buddhism. They make the Buddha Shakyamuni their 13th god. That was one way, you know, Buddhism was absorbed. And since, you know, most of the time in India, Buddhism over there were small vehicle. That is, the monk, you know, try to get some salvation for themselves. So they ignore the lay people most of the time. Lay people, you know, just come and offer them alms. That is food, clothing, and that's it. The lay people, you know, might not get more interested in it. Unless, you know, they keep on thinking that, well, by offering these, you know, they will get some merit and they will be reborn, you know, next life and to a better place. So, giving place to Islam and Hinduism. Hinduism was not present at the time of the Buddha. Hinduism is Brahmanism, reincarnation. That is, you know, they changed Brahmanism into Hinduism by saying that, well, this is the religion of all Indians, of Hindus, to stimulate their nationalism. So to think that, well, if you're really Hindu, you must go, you must become Hinduist. You're not supposed to be Buddhist. Who is Nepalese? Buddha Shakyamuni was Nepalese. The place to Islam. Islam, you know, they are very, like, cruel. That is, when nobody comes, they try to convert, you know, by the sword. That is, you know, they will kill you. That's it. Rajendra Lala Mitra wrote the Sanskrit Buddhist literature in Nepal, basing on 144 Nepalese sutra. So that is a proof. There was proof in the 18th century that there was still some Sanskrit sutra left from the time of the Buddha. And since Nepal was a remote country, you must know that in the 18th and 19th centuries, Nepal, Sikkim, Bhutan, Tibet, you know, were like a far, 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 far away countries. They were like Mars to Occidental people. Nobody ever came over there. So then when they start to know about Tibet, they know about this Lama, they know about Potala, know about all these, you know, they were in awe. And in fact, you know, there was some con man, like this guy who said he was in Tibet, and then he come back to England, and then he wrote many books about Tibet. And then later, you know, people find out that he was just a plumber living in an apartment, and he just invented everything. The reporter, you know, came and asked him, well, you said you have the third eye. In the time of, they believe it, you know, Tibetan people, you know, have the third eye. You know, a third eye, right in the forehead like this. So they came and asked him, you said in your book that you got the third eye, so where is the third eye now? He said, well, I had the third eye, but when I come back to England, you know, it started to close. Now you don't see it anymore. They'll say, well, so can you speak some Tibetan? And then they have a Tibetan guy who speaks Tibetan, try to talk to him something, because he couldn't answer. They say, well, I speak the Tibetan at the time, but since, you know, I left a long time, you know, I forgot them all. You see, so people in the world, like in all, you know, with all these countries, they thought that these are far, far away. They even called Tibet at the time, you know, Shangri-La. You remember this word, Shangri-La? It's like the heaven, the paradise. Because they think that when people over there know only eat fruits, and they live like 100 years, all of them very healthy, like 90-year-old, know, can walk like a dozen of miles every day, things like this. So English occupants and Indian scholars revived Buddhism by exploring further in the 18th century. They tried. Of course, you know, some people were just curious, but most of the time, you know, these people work for England. That is, you know, for the spy bureaus. They were spies, because at the time there was empire. You remember that? The British Empire, the Russian Empire, the Chinese Empire, and all these, you know, tried to expand. They tried to expand. And one of the history, you know, we have not know much, especially Vietnamese, is about the Central Asia. That is what we call by the Sam Chong, and the area we call the Silk Road. All these areas have been like explored by these people, by these agents. Many of these so-called explorers were spies. was no Rajendra Lala Mitra. He is a real scholar, Indian scholar, who wrote the Sanskrit Buddhist literature in Nepal. Because he went to Nepal. Nepal was close to India. So he went over there and found in the temples, in many temples, you know, the Sanskrit sutras, about 144 of them. And since you know, Indians know Sanskrit, he tried to translate them and then wrote briefly in this Sanskrit Buddhist literature in Nepal. I have a copy of this. If you want to know, I will post it on the web, on our web page, so you can download it in PDF. It's very good. An old book, very old, like 100 years ago, so more than 100 years ago. And in 1890, Sarat Chandra Das published A Journey to Lhasa in Central Tibet. And it was a bomb at the time. I mean, an explosion, not a bomb. Bomb nowadays mean you die, right? But in the time, no, it was like a hit. We call them a hit now. After being kept secret. Why? Because he was working under the order of the Bengal Bureau. That is the Viceroy of Bengal. You know something about the British Empire at the time? They say that, you know, the sun never, you understand that, right? So the Sarat Chandra Das is the scholar, an Indian scholar. He was very good. But then, you know, he worked for these people. They received order to go to Tibet because he knows Tibetans. He go to Tibet and then tried to explore and wrote on the report. And the report he sent back was kept secret. Because you remember, I just told you about all these empire, they try not to fight against each other. So all this information were kept secret. So after a while, you know, they will like censor some parts and then they put them on publication in the 1890s. Because truthfully, after that time, the Germans, the Russians, you know, came en masse. And they tried to explore further. The Russians who come from the north, and they went through on these Kazakhstan countries, and they even went to Afghanistan. The second Russian invasion later, before the Mujahideen, Sarat Chandra Das published Journey to Lhasa in Central Tibet. That was a hit. That is, you know, it was picked up by many, many countries. In fact, you know, even in the University of in America at the time, it was a sensation. And a lot of people, you know, start to dig in and try to learn more about this country, they call them Tibet. What is it? Nowadays, you know, it's easy for us. But in the time, you know, there's no way to go over there. And a Tibetan English dictionary. After that, you know, he even made that. Of course, now you understand that this is for order of the spy bureau. Because spies, you know, need to understand their language. They need to know Tibetan, to read Tibetan, to talk with the Tibetans. So they need the dictionaries. It's like Moni William, who wrote the Sanskrit English dictionary, which is still in use nowadays. But the reason he wrote this was for missionary to spread Christianism into India. He said it. I don't need to invent it. He said it in the preface of the book. Anagarika Dhammapala founded the Mahabodhi Society in 1891. This guy, man, you know, was Sinhalese. Sinhalese, which is what we call by nowadays Sri Lanka, right? But Ceylon in India were both under the control of the British Empire at the time. So he was hampered to form the Mahabodhi Society in 1891. Not only because he's good, he's strong, but he was supported by many foreigners. Madame Blavatsky, Russian, Conan Olcott, American, both of them went to Sri Lanka, that is Ceylon at the time, and tried to revive Buddhism at the time over there. Because a lot of Christians came to Sri Lanka and trying to convert people from Sri Lanka to Christianism. They succeed, of course, because many poor people, you know, will embrace anything as long as they are promised a lot of things. So, Olcott, Blavatsky went to Sri Lanka, revived Buddhism, and even formed the Theosophical Society over there. But in the time, they didn't form the Theosophical Society first. They just tried to revive Buddhism over there. And then later on, they went to India, trying to start it again. But they met with resistance, because you remember India had a caste system. So the people over there, they went directly against anything, saying to abolish the caste system. Even now they know there's an atheist league. So they tried to form the Theosophical Society then, because Theosophical Society looked less aggressive. That is, they want to associate every religion into one. So if you want to learn about that, you go to the web and type Theosophical Society. There was some in Vietnam at the time also. They called them in Vietnamese Hội Thông Thiên Học. So Anagarika Dhammapala founded the Mahabodhi Society, that which is still present at the time. The Mahabodhi is nowadays located in the area of Mahabodhi Temple. Remember that, right? You know the Mahabodhi Temple? Where the Buddha Shakyamuni get enlightened. He got enlightened under the pipala tree, ficus religiosa. And then after that, they built the Asoka, the Mahabodhi Temple. Mahabodhi means great enlightenment. Because the Buddha got enlightened there. So nowadays, if you go over there in India, you still see that. But Mahabodhi Temple were under the control of the Brahman later. So Indian Buddhism start to revive. But even now, they still meet with a big resistance from the caste system. Burmese Buddhism. Buddhism is national religion in Myanmar. Now they call them Myanmar. Mien Điện. In Vietnamese, they call Mien Điện. And the English call them Burma. They invade them for a while. Government built numerous Buddhist institutes. Since it is a national religion, and most people there, and in fact, all of them follow the small vehicle. Organized many conventions, especially the 1950s, 6,000, with more than 2,500 monks from all nations to rectify the Pali Canon. You remember the Khaosans? We had the four Khaosans. At the time, the fifth Khaosan, somebody don't count. But then the sixth Khaosan was convened in 1954 in Burma. And there are many monks to try to consolidate their Pali Canon. And in fact, the Pali Canon was consolidated at the time. Before that, it was classified by the Europeans. But they did a very poor job, because they really didn't know much about the canon. They were scholars, not the practitioners, like the monks. So this Thera, they called them the old monk and the Thera. And the big old monk, they called them Mahathera. So that is the, so Burmese Buddhism is still present at the time, nowadays. Ceylonese Buddhism, that is Buddhism from Sri Lanka. Buddhists are majority also. In 1950, Colombo organized the first meeting of the World Buddhist Fellowship Organization with the 26 countries within EU, member adopting the Buddhist flag and the Vesak and the Mahalaksikara. That is, Sri Lanka is also a Buddhist country of small vehicle, and it's still very powerful there. But there's also some faction of the Tamil Hindu, and some Christians. The Christians are small minority. Tamil Hindu are also a minority, but they are more aggressive. That is, nowadays you still hear about these Tamil resistance in Sri Lanka, because the monk over there want to establish everything under the Buddhist rule. And whenever they try to impose something like this, all the religions will resent. And then try to fight back. Somehow they start to the first meeting of the World Buddhist Fellowship. And in fact, nowadays we have this Buddhist flag drawn by Olcott, Conan Olcott, American. Commandant Onkot was the one who invented this flag. Buddhist flag, you know, was not present before. But Commandant Onkot, you know, draw that, symbolizing, you know, the aura of the Buddhas and all the thing. And the Vesak. Vesak, you know what is Vesak, right? The Phật Đản. Now in Vietnam, you know, we celebrate the Buddhist birthday. But in other countries, you know, they celebrate the birthday, the day of enlightenment, the day of leaving the house, and the Nirvana. That is, you know, the day of death. In fact, you know, in the old sutras, you know, they say that, well, the Buddha was born, get out of the family, get enlightened, and died on the same day of the 8th of the Vesakha. That is the fourth lunar month in India. The 8th of the 4th lunar month, 18 tháng 4. So the birthday, the death day, the day of enlightenment, and the day he left his house, the same. But nowadays, you know, the people from the small vehicle celebrate Vesak on the full moon of the Vesakha, that is the 4th lunar month, and celebrate only the three things: the birthday, the day of enlightenment, and the day of death, but not of the day of leaving the house. Now, in countries of big vehicles, they celebrate only the birthday of the Buddha on the 8th. They got another day for the enlightenment and another day for the death. So now, you know, at this convention, they agree, all of these countries agree that, well, we will celebrate the Buddha birthday on the Vesak. That is the full moon of the 4th. So they don't use the 8th day anymore. But things, you know, it was brought back into Vietnam. Many temples still celebrate on the 8th. Because it was in the sutras, on the teaching of the Buddhas. Because if the sutra says something, either you follow it or you don't follow it. That's it. But you don't impose. You cannot say, hey, Buddha, don't be born on that day. Be born on this day. Can do that. Either you follow or you don't follow, or you invent something. You can invent something if the person was not real, like the Bodhisattva. So you have some commemorative days for the Kuan Yin, for the Jizo, that is the old womb Bodhisattva. But these are like not real people. So you can fight any days. But for real people, you have to celebrate on their birthday. Like, you know, if you were born on the 18th of March, and now, you know, they bring some gift to you in your house and say, hey, let's party today. It's the 1st of June. Say, that's all right. So the thing about the Buddhist flag and the Vesak happened there in Sri Lanka. Thai Buddhism. Like Myanmar, Buddhism is national religion, is national religion of Thais, who has more than 200,000 monks and no nun in 20,000 temples. Burmese and Thai, you know, they don't allow women to be ordained. In fact, you know, there was no ordination for women in these countries. Government promotes research and study practice for Farang, that is the Thai word for foreigner. You come over there, you know, they call them all Farang. That is foreigner. And a lot of people, you know, come to Thailand to learn about Buddhism and try to practice over there. Many American monks, you know, get ordained in Thailand. Cambodian Buddhism. Like Thailand, Buddhism is also national religion of Khmer, who have custom to enter temple for a while before becoming mature. This you might not know because you were not born in Vietnam. But in Vietnam, you know, especially if you were born in the south, you know that Khmer people, that is Cambodian, have this custom. Like every young man, whenever you go into what we call by I don't know, they have to go into temple for a while. At least, you know, 6 months, at most 3 years, shave the head and get ordained, live like a monk from 6 months to 3 years. After that, they will disrobe and then they come back to the world. They get married, they do whatever they want. And people respect them more. Because it was like just a training, a religious training. experience and training. So whenever you go into the world, you know, you practice better, you have more compassion, you have more feeling toward other people, toward the right things. It is just like a moral education. Cambodia also organized the 6th World Buddhist Fellowship Convention. It was a small country, but then it could do something like this, you see. But you remember that Cambodia had a history of being under the Hindu religion at the time. That explained the presence of Angkor Thom, Angkor Wat, you know, on these big temples. When you come over there, you see all these Hindu deities always. See? After that, they would become converted into Buddhism later. Now, revival movement in China and surrounding countries, which are mostly great vehicles. Chinese Buddhism, you remember that, because we have learned that. During the Qing Dynasty, the Tang was the one, you know, who invaded. They don't belong to the Han. That is, you know, they were not really Chinese-born. So many Chinese people, you know, still think like, you know, they were invaded by some other people. Okay? Buddhism has decayed by superstition. Monks and Buddhists were regarded as conscious, dangerous to national existence. Because under the king, the Tang dynasty, like that, you know, many monks, you know, were imported from Tibet, and they practiced esotericism. You remember, we have learned about that, right? That is, you know, they speak a lot about all these amulets, they wear the amulet, they make all these drawings, and then try to get wealth and things like that. So people now become really superstitious, especially Buddhists, and the monk and the Buddhists were regarded as contis. You know what is contis? A cont. You have religion whenever you band together, because not only about some belief, but also some practice together, and for the enlightenment and for the happiness of all the people. A cult, you know, doesn't work like that. A cult is just a group of people who do believe in something too, common thinking. But they work only for their groups, and usually under the influence of one committee or one guy who control everything. That is what we call a cult. Like, you know, there are even some Buddhist cults, a lot of Buddhist cults also. So they claim that, well, I'm the only monk, I know everything, you have to follow me, don't go to another people. If someone tells you, don't go to another people, well, it's not true, it's not real. Okay? Don't believe in them. Because that's what the definition of con come in. You see, like if you watch the television nowadays, you know this thing about the Latter-day Saints in Texas. The Texas government claimed that these people have been like abused by some cult leaders. They tell you to do something and you really believe in it, and then you give everything to them. Well, be careful with that. So the scholars and all the people, because you remember China, you know, had a very big civilization. So people were very cultured. They were real civilized. And now, know, if you promote some superstition, they will put you in doubt right away. And Buddhists were regarded as contis, dangerous to national existence. Influence of Occidental civilization arise a national anti-superstition movement, which wiped out many temples and their monks. Because at the time of the king, many temples, although they claim that they are Buddhists, but they venerate unbelievable things. Because this was written by the master in Vietnam. You see, Occident means the West. The civilization from the West. What they call by the West, you know, is like, not India. India is in the West. But by in West, you know, they mean European. Arise of national. After the Democratic Revolution of 1912 in China, Buddhist study and practice resurfaced without superstition and with more nationalist feeling. Because now, you know, all the bad factors have been weeded out. Buddhist institutes and magazines developed, and Dharma talks become regular meetings. So that stopped, you know, in like the 1950s. But after that, you know, remember, the China was invaded by, I mean, controlled by the communist government, which destroyed a lot of things. So now if you go to the Shaolin Temple, many of these areas have been rebuilt. In fact, you know, you see many of the platform, you know, wall, are like concrete. Concrete, it didn't exist at the time. So they try to rebuild. And when you come over there to visit, you pay some money. It's like, you know, going to the zoo or something. But under the communists, all these have been destroyed because they don't believe in religion. So, but now they, you know, they open the doors and there's some reform. And some people, you know, still believe in these things. So Buddhism resurfaced in China even nowadays. Japanese Buddhism, having a long history, Buddhism was omniscient in Japan. You know what it is, omnipresent. Developed its own school. Japanese, you know, have its own school of Buddhism, like Nichiren Nyatlinton, who venerate the Lotus Sutra, and the Sukha Gakkai. Sukha Gakkai is the lay people organization from the Nichiren first, which, you know, sprout from them, but divide later, because under the Meiji government, that is, you know, the Japanese emperor, who try, you know, to discredit Buddhism. They try to promote Shintoism. Shintoism, they promoted as the national religion of Japan. Buddhism, you know, they say, were imported somewhere. But Shinto is real McCoy religion of the Japanese. So they claim themselves, they like the son and daughter of the sun goddess. So even their flag, you know, is the sun. The red spot is the sun, symbolize the sun. So they practice everything according to the sun. Japanese Buddhism, although they are Mahayanists, they celebrate nowadays on the Buddhist festival according to the solar calendar. That is, you know, the New Year's is the 1st of January. The Buddha's birthday is the 8th of April. And the Bulan Ulambana is the 15th of July. They use completely, you know, the solar calendar. They don't use the lunar calendar. While expounding others, that is the Zen. The Zen, you know, was like born in China. Of course, you know, taught by the Buddha Shakyamuni, born in China, but then, you know, were really expounded in Japan. So nowadays, if you say something about Zen, they think it's Japanese. They don't think that it was Chinese anymore. Recently, it suffered from manipulation by government, forcing marriage to monks, making Shinto national religion while spreading their idea of Great Orient. And that explains to you, you know, their military powers during the Second World War. They allied, you know, with, you know, Germany and Italy. And then, of course, you know, they lost the war. And then the Meiji government and all these guys, you know, disappeared. Now they, you know, they come back, but still Buddhism, you know, cannot regain what it has been before. Why? Because once you have the monks who become married, who are appointed to the temples, they own the temples. They can keep the money. Now you tell them, now go back, shave your head, divorce your wife. go back, you know, and give me back your temple. They will say, what? You're crazy. So that is the reason why. Nowadays, you know, see, if you think something about the Japanese monks, you must powder, because there are still some celibate monks, real monks. But many of them, you know, become like a owner of the temples. And they like it. You come with me. If not, go away. That's it. They are not really monk anymore. Korean Buddhism. This didn't exist in the lesson. Having a longer history than Japanese, because Korea, you know, was very good. And in fact, many Korean masters, you know, have been present in India. They were even present in India at the time. Korean Buddhism has seen glorious days, and they print their Korean Tripitaka. Vietnam, you know, never had any Tripitaka printed. But Korea, they had their Tripitaka print, and even in Korea. and built many ancient temples. Ancient Korea were really Buddhist. In 20th century, Buddhism suffered the hardest blow in Asia. Now Buddhism in Korea suffered the hardest blow in all Asia. Why? First, Korean Buddhism has sustained Japanese invasion in like the 1930s, 1920s. The Japanese invade Manchuria. You remember that, right? They invade and then they invade all Korea. So now, even nowadays, you see that a lot of Koreans hate Japanese. They don't like Japanese. Because when Japanese come over there, the thing with Buddhism is that they apply their feeling toward Buddhism in Japan to Korea. That is, they force the monks to get married. Either you get married, and then we will appoint you head of the temple. You own the temple, or you get out. Because before that, before the 18th century, Buddhism in Korea was very good. Real monks, they never come into the cities. They are prohibited to come into the cities. They practice only in the temples, in the remote areas. So they practice really good. Once you go into temple, that means that you leave everything. You don't care about anything anymore. But nowadays, Japanese people say, you go over there. You get married, you monk, you nun, get married together. You don't get married, go down, go back. So that was the hardest blow. Because, you see, Buddhism in Korea has been present for 1,000 years. And now some invader who come in and get do things like this, well, that's very, very bad. No wonder nowadays, if you read something in Korean, they still hate Japanese. Personal like that. And appoint their headman. Then after the war, now you remember the war in 1950s, at first the communists going south, they even invaded Seoul nowadays. So then the United Nations sent the troops in, tried to push back. Truthfully, the Koreans were not in majority. Most of them were Chinese. Because Chinese, the Mao Zedong, communist Chinese in the time helped a lot. Because Korean was not really numerous at the time. So they tried to invade. And in fact, they have invaded. The United Nations sent the troops and pushed them back. Pushed them back and then have the agreement to divide Korea in two nations, the North Korea and the South Korea. The North Korea under communist control. The South Korea under a free country. Now the North, under communism, you already know that they suppress all the religions. All the religions, not only Buddhism. So they didn't practice anymore. And in fact, there was no more Buddhists in the north. In the south, at first, some people tried to revive, but they still met with the fight, like in Japan. Why can the south suffer from internal division between married and true monks? There are some true monks. Now, they hide in the countries, now they come back. And then they try to practice again. But the married monk, nowadays they own the temple. They don't want to let these people in. Say, hey, you out. I enjoy this. This is mine. This is my wife. So the monk and said this. This is venerable and Mrs. Venerable. Venerable, thick, whatever. And then Mrs. Venerable, thick, whatever. And they sit together with that. And that's something. So they fight issue with others. Sometimes you read on or you watch on TV and saw these monks fighting issue of them. Because of this. Most of these virulent people were the married monks. So they have money. A lot of money. The real monks who practice don't have any money. And also as well as aggressive proselytization by Christians. That is very aggressive. Now, in other countries, in Vietnam, in China, there was conversion, but they don't make it too open, like in Korea. In fact, you see all these. I went into YouTube, and they show. Now, in 2008, some monk sitting down with arm, and then a minister coming in and tap on his head like this, and he showed him publicly like this. They post it on YouTube and nobody do anything. So then practicing Buddhism in Korea is quite dangerous. Because now they rely too much on Christian people who come in and pour their money to get on this. So be careful with them, because they try just to convert. Because when they think that they can convert someone, you know, they will go to heaven. So, diffusion of Buddhism. Okay, try to finish all this, so we try to do it really fast. Diffusion of Buddhism in the world. After research of Buddhism for political and religious reasons, many scholars start to ponder on that ancient religion of Buddhism, then embrace at last. Like Conan Oncott, who already said that, right? Madame Blavatsky, Mr. Rhys Davies, and Mrs. Rhys Davies were like an English scholar, very renowned in the Pali. Many Europeans became ordained, real monk like Nana Moli, who was like a German, Bodhi Bhikkhu, who was American. He was American, and in fact, you know, he was ordained by a Vietnamese monk, Vinod Thich Nhat Hanh, when they both study in United States. Jack Confield, he's American, belonging to the Peace Corps. He went to Thailand, and then he, after the sting over there, he gets into the temple and he get ordained and he practices over there until he come back to the United States. When he came back to the United States, he still wore the robe. After like a week, he has to disrobe, because nobody offered him any arm at all. And he cannot walk around like this. Robert Aiken, a Zen practitioner, and he was ordained in Japan, along with his wife, Ann Aiken. Tenzin Palmo. So you see that, Robert Aiken and Ann Aiken, both husband and wife ordained, and they still live together, because Japan, you remember, we just said, right? Japan has some this kind of tradition. Tenzin Palmo was an English woman who practiced in Lhasa. She lived in a cave for 9 years. Remember that, right? The story of it? Cave in the snow. Look up. Cave in the snow by Vicky McKenzie, who wrote the story of Tenzin Palmo. Tenzin Palmo is the name of the girl, an English girl, who left everything and went to Tibet, and lived in the cave for 9 years. She is now very, very now, Tenzin Palmo. Either, you know, you click on Tenzin Palmo, or you click on Cave in the Snow, the book by Vicky McKenzie about her life. John Laurie is a Zen master who has good, very renowned practice now in the United States, spreading Buddhism back in their countries. Presence of Occidental Buddhists in every international Buddhist convention. That is true. Every convention nowadays, you know, you have a lot of European people from all over the world, even Spanish. Adaptation into vegetarianism, veganism, New Age, and holistic views. Because see, one thing about Buddhism is that it adapts to the culture, to the countries. So when it comes to Vietnam, you know, the practice of Buddhism in Vietnam looked very different from the one, you know, practice in Thailand. So now when it comes to the Occidental countries, like America or something, it morphs into something else, like a New Age. You know, New Age, they believe something, or just vegetarianism. They don't want to eat any meat. Or veganism, that is completely absence of any animal products. No milk, no butter, no egg. Vegan. It's different from vegetarianism. Vegetarianism, like Ăn Chay, you still can drink milk. Somebody even eat egg. They still eat egg. Or some, you know, drink milk, eat cheese. There's no problem with that. But veganism is complete absence of any animal product at all. They don't even wear shoes, leather shoes. The New Age and the holistic view. See, because they need to morph into something kind of different. Instead of, you know, sitting down and chanting like Vietnamese people. Intonation Buddhist conventions, sensation of unification. First, you know, all these conventions aim to unify all Buddhists in the world, which is, you know, like a dream, because, you know, Buddhism, you know, is an individual thing. We'll say about that later. After the 15th Colombo Convention, many follow-through conventions have been organized. You can read this at home, because truthfully, they didn't accomplish much. They just no meet and then talk and then go home. That's it. But everybody will practice according to their own. Temptation of unification stumbled due to nature of Buddhism, which was individual enlightenment. Because you cannot get collective enlightenment like other religions. In other religions, you can go into the stadium and then you get collective enlightenment. But in Buddhism, you cannot get to this. If any Buddhist who try to do this thing, he's a contest. Remember that. You must have individual enlightenment. That is, you know it for yourself. In fact, you know, the Buddha taught you in the Kalama Sutta. You remember we said many times. That is the teaching of the Buddha, where he said that, well, don't believe in what I say. Don't believe in what it was said by your parents. Don't believe in anything which is dictated by your culture, by your traditions, by your whatever. See, you remember that. It's a very short sutta, but it's very good. And in fact, you know, Buddha Shakyamuni was the only one, you know, who dared to say that. No other guy, you know, can say that. Favoring multiplicity of practice. That is, you can practice one way, the other guy can practice another way. And we still can associate together. You can depart, you know, why? Oh, I don't like to depart. I just want to sit. I don't want to sit. I just want, you know, to get out, you know, and do good things to all people. That's good. And utmost freedom. That is, you know, nobody can force anything to go. You can force people to go to temple. If you don't go to temple, you'll be kicked out or something. No. Convention become more regional, while multiplying to great extents. Revival movement in Vietnam. On the road long before independence, Buddhism in Vietnam has also suffered discrimination and proselytization after the French occupation. You know the history of Vietnam. If you don't know, go read some. Revival started in 1920 with support from nationalistic officials to organize Buddhist Institute. Then the Buddhist organization were allowed to form in all three regions, which published different magazines. It was cut short by the wars. One of the reasons these officials, you know, become like indignated and try to reorganize the Buddhist thinking is that the French were really aggressive at the time. In fact, you know, they destroyed those temples to bring other things. Now, it's not, you know, something I just invented, but that was truth. One of the temples is the Chùa Bảo Ân, called them the Chùa Quan Thượng in Hanoi. French called them Pagode Discipline. Now, even if you go into this web page, they show you the picture of this temple. It's big, very pretty. But the French people know just appropriate it, raise it to be on the post office of Hanoi. They could be somewhere else, but they just do that. They just want to destroy things. But since, you know, we were in occupation at the time, nobody dared to say anything. But the officials, Vietnamese officials, become indignant. They have their own feeling. Say that, well, I thought that you people, you say that you were Occidental people, you were European people, you are free of thinking, things like this. Now you just, you know, hide under some veil to come in and to spread this Christianism always. So they try to fight back, but they can't fight openly. So that is reason for the revival movement. But on this, they were cut short by the war. Of course, you know, the World War, and then after the World War, you know, the war between the National, the Communists, and the French. Only for a few years, and then the French, you know, ran away. On the May 6, 1951, you have to remember this day, 51 delegates from 6 main organizations, 3 organizations of monks, and 3 organizations from lay people, from the 3 regions. Because in the time, you remember, Vietnam was divided in 3 regions, the north, the south, and the center. And to form the General Association Tam Hợp of Vietnam. In 1950, Communist North closed down most temples, dropped monks, because that was in communism. Under communist countries, monks, you know, need to be dropped into the forced military things. Buddhism in the south were more developed, being temple and Prince Sutta, even got involved in political and turmoil. Now you learn more about that, because many monks, you know, learn from that too. Some were killed, and some were like wiser. Because truthfully, Buddhists not supposed to inform in political things, which was like something not really right. The worldly truth and the ultimate truth. Once you become a monk, you want the deliverance, you want enlightenment. That is, you want to seek for the ultimate truth. The worldly truth is what we do nowadays. We want money, we want fame, we want food, we want wife, we want husband, we want clothing. And the more we get, the more we like. That's worldly truth. Worldly truth does not deliver us, does not help us to get enlightenment, and make us get deeper into dukkha, suffering. So being a monk meaning leaving the worldly truth out, embracing only the ultimate truth. But once they get involved in politics, they embrace the worldly truth. Easy to understand. Conclusion, after 25 centuries, Buddha's teachings still shine everywhere in the world, without coercion, with full respect for individual intentions and freedom. You see that? Buddhists no, don't come to your house and say that, hey, you come to the temple, you go to Hải Đức, to Hải Đức, ăn ngon lắm, you, many food, lot of food, free food, and then free car wash, come over there. Never think about that. You come to the temple, you have to wash their car. Yeah, even to mop the floor and clean the bathroom. Nobody pay you anything. So, with full respect for individual intelligence and freedom, not found in any organized religion. You see that? Like, you know, people who receive the Bodhisattva here, right? The Bodhisattva precept. You receive it before, you sit in front. You receive one day later, you sit in the back. Even children, you know, they sit in front. And if you receive later, you sit in the back. No other religion will let you do that. No wonder it will keep on shining further and further as a source of consolation and compassion indispensable to this world, which is the Asaha. We finished today. We leave the place. In chapter 11. Nguyện đem công đức này hướng về khắp tất cả đệ tử và chúng sinh đều chọn thánh Phật.